Thank you for listening to this podcast from Renew San Diego, a church for the good of all our neighbors in North Park, San Diego. If you're ever in the area on Sunday mornings, we'd love to welcome you. More information at renewsandiego.org. Share with a friend. See you soon.
Today's reading is from Luke chapter 24, verses 13 to 25. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" That same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered there. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road, and how he had made known to them in the breaking of the bread. This is the word of God. Please take a moment for silent reflection.
One of the privileges we have in pastoral ministry is just being able to hear the stories of brothers and sisters, to have conversation, hearing about what God's doing in the life of people. And one such occasion, I was visiting with this individual who was a little older than me and was wrestling with his relationship with God. He was kind of, shall we say, overthinking things a little bit and kind of really bearing down and trying to figure out answers to his questions. But at one point in the conversation, it turned to a memory that he had as a child when he was learning how to ride a bicycle. His mother was out front trying to help him to ride a bike, and here he was on the bike and starting to go, and it was working. And as it was working, he just started to, he was amazed, like, I think I'm doing it. And as he got farther and farther from his mother, he faintly heard her cry out, something like, keep pedaling. And he turned around just to make sure he was hearing it right, and went, boom, straight down as he turned around. We're going to come back to this story later, but this story points out to us that knowing God is more like riding a bike than you might think. The resurrection is the ultimate revolutionary event in all of human history. It is a paradigm shift like none other. And on this third Sunday of Easter, Luke is telling us about two people who knew what was going on in Jerusalem with Jesus and how their life changed because of their encounter with him. Now, this story is found, as as Lisa said, in Luke chapter 24. But we pick up the story in verse 13. In the first part of Luke 24, which is why he says on that same day, the tomb was empty. That Sunday morning, the tomb was empty. And as the women arrive in the morning, it says very specifically at the beginning of Luke 24, it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, mother of James. They go and see an empty tomb. So they run back to tell the disciples. And it says in the early part of Luke 24, but these words to them, to the disciples, seemed to them like an idle tale. You see, in the first century, I'm so sorry that this is the case, but women's testimony had no legal weight in the courts. Right? If you wanted to convince somebody of something, the last thing you would do in that culture is to have a woman be your spokesperson because of those cultural values. So the women come back, and they're saying this incredible thing that the tomb is empty. And it says here that the disciples received it as an idle tale. It's a word, leros, in Greek. It's the only time that it shows up in the New Testament. And it really means foolish and unreliable, nonsense, drivel, silly talk, and babbling. Not so good, right? It's kind of like, no way, Jose. That's not happening, right? Not only so, but Hippocrates, Greek physician, had used this term in diagnosing someone who has an incoherent rambling or is feverish or a delirious patient, right? This is no bueno. This is not good, right? The women were socially marginalized. Their voice didn't matter in a court of law, and yet they were the first to witness the empty tomb, and they were the first to witness about the empty tomb. So, the first Easter morning is a story about the most important announcement in human history. It's being made by people whose testimony was culturally invisible and being dismissed by the very community that should have been most prepared to receive it. That's the setup for that very same day. So that very same day, we find in our passage today, two people walking to Emmaus. Now, if you look at geography, and scholars are trying to figure out exactly where Emmaus is, and there's some debate, but we know it's away from Jerusalem. They are walking away from Jerusalem at the greatest moment in human history. They are disillusioned. They feel disenfranchised. They feel completely disoriented, and frankly, completely dejected and in despair. They know some of the outer realm of the disciples, kind of the disciples with the disciples. They are familiar with the story of Jesus. Many scholars think that they would have actually met Jesus before, known some of his disciples personally, because of the nature of this passage. But they're walking away from Jerusalem in this incredible dissonance and despair. And then we're told in verse 15 that Jesus appears and walks with them. Great. So they see Jesus. It's all good. No, it's not all good. They don't recognize him. In fact, not only do they not recognize him, but the passage says that they were kept from recognizing him. That seems kind of mean. Like, God, why are you doing this? Why are you playing games with your precious people? Why would you keep them from being able to recognize you? Now, that word for recognize means a certain personal recognition. It's not the, oh, I think I've seen you before, but it's actually that, oh my gosh, it's you. It's this historic knowing. It's this intimate relational knowing. They didn't see him. And at first glance, it looks like being kept from seeing him seems kind of mean, kind of harsh. But as we'll see, it was actually very kind. In the keeping and being kept, the patristics, the early church fathers, they're trying to help us. They say that they're trying to help us. Luke is trying to help us illustrate the nature of resurrection faith. The visual, face-to-face, immediate knowing, like recognition, information, it's the wrong kind of knowing here. Resurrection faith is a new mode of knowing. It's a heart knowing. It's a knowing before your brain makes sense of the data. And in this story, it requires the scriptures and the sacrament for the heart knowing to come to full force. This face-to-face knowing in just the moment is temporarily suspended. Augustine, the great kind of Western theologian from the 4th century, said, Christ is teaching them how to see before he allows them to see. And in that, God is being very kind. When I was in college back in the 1900s, and before, there, I remember one day coming to the bookstore at Fresno State University, and there were these posters and frames all over the steps up to the book, like hundreds of them. It was wild. Like, what's going on? And when I went up there, this would have been in the early 90s, there, all of these posters were just like squibbles. They were like almost pixelated colors. There was nothing there. It was just almost like a TV that's kind of gone off and it's just like static. It kind of looked like that. But these people were riveted, sitting on the steps looking at all of these fuzzy pictures. And I sat down in front of one of them, and somebody came by and said, you just need to keep looking at it. And I was just looking at it and staring at it for no good reason. Nothing was happening. And they were telling me, there's a picture in there. There's something inside of there. Trust me. And the more they told me that, the more I stared to try to see it. I couldn't see it. And if you know me as an Enneagram 1, I'm not going to take no for an answer. So I sat there for like 45 minutes, right? Like, this guy can see it and that gal can see it, so I'm going to see it. Finally, once I relaxed and stopped trying so hard, all of a sudden, boom, this three-dimensional picture popped out of those posters. And then this got popularized later in something called the Magic Eye, little books. Maybe you remember those kinds of things. This is kind of like that. We're looking on the surface. Maybe you see something, but it's not until your brain actually looks beyond just the data that you're able to see a more full picture where you're not straining or trying. But more on this later. In verse 17, Jesus says to them, this is kind of a paraphrase, what y'all talking about? Right? These guys, I imagine that these two who are talking, they're probably just not nonchalant talking about like the weather. They are animated. They are energized. They are upset. They are, as we'd like to say, befuddled, puzzled. there is a lot of energy in what's going on. What are you all talking about? And it says explicitly in the passage, they stop and are sad. The question stops them in their tracks, and they are very sad. They have just lost Jesus. It says here in verse 18, Cleopas and his companion, basically they say, I don't think they said this, but are you kidding me? What's happening right now? You cannot be serious, dude. Are you the only person, the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know what's been going on? You have got to be kidding me. What kind of question is this? Almost taking offense. And to be saying that Jesus is a stranger, this is this idea that they don't really belong to Jerusalem. They're kind of on the outside. They're on the fringes. They're there because of activities, but they don't really know, or they're not really from the place. It's this idea of being a sojourner, a resident alien, out of place, temporary resident, not belonging there. But seriously, don't you know what's been going on? All the crazy? Jesus says, what things? Tell me about it. There's humor here. Like, really? And then they go on to this kind of this long monologue. Things about Jesus of Nazareth, the prophet who was full of mighty deeds and mighty words in front of God and all of these people. And then notice the pronoun, our chief priests and leaders handed him over to Rome to be condemned and put to death, ultimately crucified. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, 21, it says very specifically, to be crucified, it's a disqualifying event. Like, it's not just painful, it's not just awful, but if you're crucified, you are written off. You are illegitimate. You are exposed for being false. It was shameful. And even now, it might be worth pausing that the most awesome, in terms of awful, grotesque, oppressive, terrorizing symbol of pain and death, God submitted himself to and has now made it the symbol of new life, new hope, forgiveness, reconciliation, and redemption. It's interesting, isn't it, how words fail to get to the bottom of the fullness of something so powerful and so good. But they go on. We had all hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. This idea of redeem is like making payment for. It could be freeing a slave or releasing a prisoner. And the key narrative in the Hebrew mind, remember, is the Exodus, right? The Hebrew people are subject to a tyrannical, oppressive regime, and their way of life and their way of worship and their freedom to be God's covenant people and to live in God's covenant way in his kingdom has been oppressed and has been crushed. And so they're thinking, okay, this is what God did in the kingdom of Egypt. This is what he's going to do with us in this kingdom of Rome, or now the Roman Empire, right? It's going to be the new Exodus. And instead of liberating us from Egypt, he's going to liberate us from Rome. So it's political and national. God is going to overthrow the Roman Empire. It's also mixed with a restoration of the Davidic kingdom. There had been a split in the kingdom, and it's bringing all of God's people back in that mini diaspora that had occurred by the first century. They're thinking a king on a throne, not a teacher on a cross. They're thinking of the full regathering of the dispersed Hebrew people. And then finally, that God was going to vindicate Israel over its enemies. He was going to judge the oppressors, not die for them. And then verse 22, they keep going. Oh, there's more. I think the word was moreover. I can imagine Cleopas being like, and that's not all. There's more. Some women from our group, again, it says our group, so he knows these disciples. They surprised us. They went to the tomb this morning. Well, wait a second. He knows this. There's no Twitter yet. There's no text messaging, group chat, whatever. They must have been there or in proximity to know what was going on. They didn't find his body, though. But they say they saw a vision of angels who said that he was alive. So some of our guys went to confirm. Indeed, the tomb was empty, but Jesus wasn't there. And then they left. They left because the women's testimony apparently wasn't good enough. And then verse 25. It doesn't say this in the Greek, but I think it's something like this. Really? Is that what you think has been going on? Honestly, Jesus says, how foolish you are and how slow of heart you are to believe. Man, that seems kind of harsh again. What do you mean how foolish you are? This word for foolish, it means to be unminded and without understanding and having thought things through all the way. It's taking things at face value, but a failure to be able to see the big picture and to reason through it. And then notice what Jesus says, slow of heart. Now, he's not talking about some sort of arrhythmia. He's not talking about low blood pressure. This is your spirit and your soul and the very center of your being is slow to awaken to what has really been happening. There's this failure at the deepest part of their inner person to receive and integrate what the prophets have actually said. You're slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. And then it's not in there again in the Greek, but I can only imagine Jesus saying, and you're going to make me spell it out for you, aren't you? And it says here, was it not necessary for the Messiah to suffer these things and then to enter his glory? I mean, it's just falling on deaf ears. Absolutely falling on deaf ears. And you can't blame them. This is the paradigm. This is the context. This is the framework. This is the meta-narrative that they're interpreting all of these events through. And it's nothing but despairing. And then Luke gives us one verse. I want to have a little talk with Luke. One verse. Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself and all of the scriptures. How about a whole chapter on that? That would be awesome. I would love to see the details of the things that Jesus must have said in that time together. You see, their view of redemption was too small. Instead of liberation from Rome, they were going to be now liberated from sin and death. The very spiritual dynamics that cause a Rome. Instead of restoration of their own little kingdom, now there's going to be the restoration of the whole human family towards God. You're blessed, Israel, to be a blessing to others. All the nations, the ethnos, the ethnicities, the people groups are going to be blessed through you, which is literally true, ultimately, through Jesus. Instead of vindication of Israel over her enemies, it's going to be the vindication of the crucified one over the powers of sin and death. And that changes everything. Sin and death have no claim on us anymore. Sin and death have no power over us anymore. The sting of death itself has been taken away. We are now free to love. Even those who persecute us, even those who seem to be on the surface against us, we are no longer under the shackles of slavery to evil and sin. We are restored to our God-given vocation in the world, to steward the world in light of God's goodness, freedom, and wholeness. Sin, death, and the devil have a genuine claim on humanity spiritually. And it's not just a legal friction, but it's a real dominion. I don't know how evil works. I don't want to know how evil works. I just know that evil is. And we would like to put our heads in the sand and say, no, it doesn't. It's just an education problem. It's just a whatever problem. But at the end of the day, if the 20th century didn't teach us anything, and if the first quarter of the 21st century didn't teach us anything, evil is real. And Christ has undone its power. He enters enemy territory. He engages the powers on their own terms, on the ground, as it were, and defeats them at their own game. The resurrection itself is a victory that death cannot hold him, and therefore cannot hold those who are in him. Jesus has freed us. He has shown us, and he has empowered us to live like him. We no longer live as strangers in God's kingdom, but now we learn to abide with Jesus, identifying with Jesus, living the good life, blessed are those, with God and with one another. It is a total 100% paradigm shift. And we see time and again, Luke himself, a physician, writing what we now is called the Gospel of Luke, but also writing the book of Acts in the early church, where he has stories time and again. I don't care if it's Cornelius or Peter or Saul turned Paul. Time and again, when people see with their hearts who Jesus is and what he has done, it literally changes everything. Everything. It is a fundamental reorientation. So, Jesus has just done a much better job talking to them than I just did, with all these details about how everything filled in. Verse 28, as they got closer to where they were headed, Jesus feigned like he was going to move on. He knew he had them. It's hitting me right now how beautiful it is that God doesn't force himself on us, but he invites us. He empowered them by not revealing himself just to their senses. He even empowered them by having them be in a place where they needed to invite him. But they urged him strongly. That's the language. I use the word begged. They begged him. Please, please stay with us. Like, it's almost nighttime. Day's almost over. You need to eat and sleep. You need to be safe anyway. Things are crazy right now. Why don't you stay with us? Please. So he did. And the first thing they did was they ate because they were hungry, because Emmaus is far, apparently. It's nighttime already. And it says he came to the table. And look at what Luke says. It's right there. He took bread. He blessed it. He broke it. And then he gave it to them. Sound familiar? Verse 31. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. Same word all the way back before. They didn't recognize him. Now they recognize him. Wait a second. They were walking with Jesus this entire time. They were hearing him exposit about himself from the only scriptures they knew, which is our Old Testament, mostly the Pentateuch. There's something going on that they know that they want him to stay, and they still don't see him. But it's not until he takes the bread and he gives thanks for it, blesses it, breaks it, and then gives it, that finally they recognize him. That full, that certain, that personal recognition. And then boom, he vanishes from their sight. He's no longer visible to them with their eyes. He is now known by them in their hearts. How do we know that? because they didn't freak out when he was gone. Like, oh no, we just lost it. What? Well, I had so many more questions. There was more. I really wanted to know about the whole Moses thing. Like, that's not what happened. In fact, it says within that hour. So I think they ate. I think they were hungry. But it says within that hour, they actually went back to the very place they were leaving because of despair. Think of what happened. They knew Christ risen for the first time. They go at that hour, they get up, they return to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and the companions, which says to me either they asked a lot of questions in Jerusalem or they knew where they were hanging. They went to them. It's verse 34, it says they were saying, the disciples, I think that is that the Lord had risen indeed and that he had appeared to Simon. And then they come in to corroborate, right? Cleopas and his companion told what that had happened to them. And then it says in verse 35 how Jesus had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread. I have mentioned her before, but I'll mention her again because I imagine most who heard of her name probably didn't go out and just buy her magnum opus. There is a woman named Esther Lightcap Meek who is a Christian epistemologist. What does that mean? She's a philosopher, a PhD level philosopher, who has studied what it means to know and how we know as humans. When she was 13 years old, growing up in the church, she had an odd question: how do I know God is real? Well, we all have that question. But then she went further. How do I know I'm real? How do I know that what is real isn't just in my head? And she had all of these epistemic questions. The study of being known. Well, as she continued to grow, she realized, oh, I'm asking philosophical questions. That was news to her. Then in college, she learned that there's actually a whole course of study, a discipline called philosophy. And so when she heard that, I think it took all of 12 hours for her to change whatever her major was to philosophy, and she did her PhD on Michael Polanyi, who was a Hungarian physicist for whom two Nobel Prizes came out of his lab, who worked closely with Einstein post-World War II. But eventually, Polanyi realized that in terms of a scientific-only view, and by that I mean a particular way at coming at data and understanding, that there were large swaths of what it means to know that science was missing. So he left the hard sciences and went into philosophy and started to write on epistemology. So she did her PhD on that. Whew! So there's lots of books out there, but her magnum opus is called Loving to Know. And on the front cover is Caravaggio's painting of the Road to Emmaus, of that supper appearance, which is why I have these really strange-looking high-top shoes that are of that painting that comes from saintsandsneakers.com. You can go there. Shameless plug. Esther says that we have a broken epistemic default in the West. Modernity has sold us a bill of goods saying knowledge is what you know. It's data. It's the right information. Friends, information doesn't transform anything. It's super important. Holy smokes. I'm so grateful for modern science. Don't get me wrong. But there's so much more to knowing. Let's go back to the bicycle analogy. I guarantee you this person I was talking to who started riding his bike with his mom, she did not hand him at all the physical equations or the calculus of how balance works on a bicycle, because that's not how we learn. That's not how we know. He had to get his keister on that bike and actually submit to the process with his entire full-bodied experience to trust the process, to submit himself to all of it, so all of who he was can learn what it would mean to ride a bike. Knowing God is much more like riding a bike than it is downloading bullet points from a spreadsheet. These people, Cleopas and his companion, had all of the right information. They had the Old Testament scriptures. They had seen Jesus. They were walking with Jesus as he was expositing. But it wasn't until they were at the table that it all clicked. Esther is a delight. You can look her up, watch some YouTube videos. She's laughing all the time. She's just a delightful person. She calls it epistemic therapy that she does. Epistemic therapy. Where our heart, our body, and our head can integrate together to know God. Jesus never said to his disciples, "Come, understand me. Come, exposit me. Come, make sense of me." He said, "Come and follow me." And by follow, he meant, come and trust me long enough that you can see that what I say and what I do is who you've always been meant to be. Let's pray together. Lord, we thank you so much for this passage. It is in some ways humorous, in other ways baffling and puzzling. But at its heart, Lord, is an invitation for us indeed to have hearts that see you. And in hearts that see you, have hearts that ask, could it be? Could it be that you indeed somehow, by the power of God, are raised unto new life? And this resurrection life, these places all around us and even in us that seem dead or skewed towards or bent towards evil, Lord, even those places you can restore. So guide, direct, give us eyes to see and ears to hear and hearts to know. And that as we follow you in your unfailing love, we will know you and the truth of your power and goodness all the more. Amen. When we consider Jesus and we see him for who he is, we want to respond by giving back to Jesus all that we have. We come to a time of offering where we give our tithes and our gifts to the ministries of Renew, which go to our ministry partners, Mexico and India and South Sudan. And many of you give online.